Jill Elaine Hughes writes for newspapers as well as other publications, and we talked to her about a year ago about Amelia Earhart. There's a story out this week that is saying that the skeletal remains that were found on this island maybe are Amelia Earhart's. And this is all big news, but I know it's not big news to a woman named Jill Elaine Hughes, who joins us on the phone right now, because I swear we had this conversation about a year ago. Hey, Jill, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you, Matt?
Good. Thank you so much for staying up and getting on the phone with us. You and I had this conversation about a year ago, and now this is a big story, but hello, you were saying a year ago that there's a good chance she survived on this island for a year. Why are we caring about this now?
Well, this is a story that comes up periodically in the news. There's a group called TIGAR, which is an acronym called the Institute for Historic Aircraft Recovery, and they're led by a really smart guy, a scientist named Rick Gillespie, who has essentially been testing a hypothesis that Amelia Earhart didn't actually, when she disappeared in 1937, that she didn't go down in the ocean when she ran out of fuel, as people thought, that she actually was able to land her plane on an island, not the island she had planned to land on, which was Howland Island, but an island further south of there called Gardner Island at the time, and Nikumarora was what that island is called now.
Okay.
There was a small amount of evidence that Gillespie used in the late 80s to kind of form a predecessor to the current hypothesis, and over about 25, almost 30 years now, gradually more and more evidence has been gathered, both by him and through the organization. Anyone literally in the world who has information or has skills or has scientific analysis abilities has the opportunity to kind of work with TIGAR on continuing to collect data, refine data. So it's done almost in, I hate to use this term, but the wiki form, that anyone who wants to participate can help contribute to the data set and refine the data set.
Okay.
So there was a skeleton discovered on Gardner Island, which is what it was called at that time, in the 1940s.
In 1940 itself, I believe, right? Like 3 years after she disappeared, 1940,
correct.
They find a skeletal remain. And that was, let me just try to get through the story real quick so I can ask you the new questions, and then you correct me where I'm wrong. They find skeletal remains, they test them, they determine at the time these seem to be a male, probably not Amelia, and now the bones have been lost. The reason it's back in the news again is because they've taken the data they had from it, had people study it again now, and they're saying now, you know what, we think that was a wrong conclusion, that these are probably, by finding a photo of Amelia where she's showing her forearm, they were able to determine the length of her forearm, and now they believe that actually this bone, while there's no DNA evidence or anything like that to say it's Amelia Earhart, they do believe it's the right size to be a woman of about the size and ethnic background of Amelia Earhart, right?
Well, that is true, but that determination was actually made in 1998 by two forensic anthropologists. Karen Burns and Richard Jantz. These are two forensic anthropologists that analyzed measurements that were taken by the British colonial government, which actually found those bones in 1940 when they were exploring the island as a possible colony. But what happened is one of those same forensic anthropologists, Richard Jantz, he did a subsequent analysis, and that's where they did the analysis of the forearm and the photograph and actually calculating something that's called a distal to humeral ratio, because there is a ratio on a normal person, you know, the average woman born in the late 19th century, which Amelia Earhart was, had an average radius to humerus ratio. These are two bones in your arm. The humerus is the upper arm bone, and the radius is one of the two bones in your lower arm. The average woman of her ethnicity and age and who was born at that time was 0.73. But Earhart, as anyone who kind of knows her can tell from photographs and films of the time, she was a very tall, statuesque woman. She had kind of an unusual physique for her, versus her contemporaries. The forensic anthropologist found that the ratio for these bones is actually 0.76, which is quite you know, I guess to forensic anthropologists, this is an exciting discovery because it's unusual. And so there was another analysis, and again, this was an analysis of those bone measurements, which are all that survive. We've never found the actual skeleton. That calculation was done by a guy. Let me just backtrack a second. The photograph that you were referring to was a photograph that was of Amelia, which shows her in a short-sleeve shirt. There's not a lot of photographs that show that, but this one does. It was a publicity photo released by Lockheed Aircraft, kind of in advance of her round-the-world flight. Amelia was flying a Lockheed Electra, and so Lockheed kind of took this as an opportunity to promote their product line. And so there's a guy named Shuffling Papers.
There's a lot to remember here.
Oh, yes, and I'm a total nerd about this. This is like my hobby. Jeff Glickman, and he runs a company called Fotech. He's a board-certified forensic examiner, and he has done a lot of forensic photo analysis for law enforcement agencies, for the government, and he frequently offers his services to TIGAR. He did an analysis of this photo where he compared it to both, you know, kind of your typical X-ray of a woman's arm and elbow and whatnot, and then did a comparison of what those ratios look like versus kind of the unusual ratios you see in a woman of Earhart's physique, and then calculated the humeral, or basically extrapolated, if you will, the humeral to radial ratio of the right arm, the left arm, rather, on this photo versus those measurements that were found, and calculated that essentially they are also 0.76. So while this is not considered in any way 100% conclusive because he was extrapolating off of a photograph.
Right. But it means that it's possible that those bones were her. It's possible that they weren't as well. We don't know.
Correct.
And why did they determine, because she had a co-pilot with her or her navigator, why did they dismiss the possibility that they were his bones?
They haven't dismissed the possibility that they were his bones.
Okay.
Because obviously with absent DNA evidence, you can't. But Noonan was actually shorter than Earhart.
Okay.
His physique was quite a bit different. She was quite tall. He was quite short. And when they did the forensic analysis back in 98 of those skeletal remains, there's obviously a lot more data available now in 1998 versus in the 1940s when forensic anthropology wasn't really a science yet. That they met the criteria that would match a female skeleton versus a male skeleton.
Okay.
And there's, go ahead.
Okay, so let's jump ahead a little bit. Let's talk about this island where she landed. Possibly, because we don't know. The prevailing theory was always that they just crashed in the ocean and they're lost forever. But this theory has been around for a while. And didn't I also read that, well, let's talk about the island for a little bit. This Nikumaro Island is what it's called now. And at the time you said it was called, did you say Garden Island?
Gardner Island.
It was Gardner Island. It's not an island in the general sense of the term, though, right? Explain this island, because as I understand, it's not your general tropical lush island. This is this a volcanic island? Is that why it's there?
It's what they yes. It's basically what they call a coral atoll. So what you have is a dormant volcano that was, you know, deep in the ocean, and so this is extremely deep ocean in the South Pacific. This is probably the deepest ocean, deepest water anywhere on the planet. But there is this volcanic formation that rises up out of the seafloor. The island that you're seeing is really not much of landmass. There is a small amount of landmass, which is essentially the top of what was the volcano, and including the crater. And the crater now forms what is called a freshwater lagoon, which formed, you know, through rainwater kind of filling up the crater. And what's around it, because it looks like, if you look at it from space, it looks kind of like an elongated letter U, because in the middle there's this, lagoon, which is a filled-in crater of a volcano, and then around it is land that formed over millions of years because there's a coral reef that formed around the edges of the volcano. Kind of coral kind of latched onto this land here. And then the coral reef kind of goes out. This is very small. It's less than a couple of miles around, and it's kind of forming a shelf, if you will. And part of that reef is actually submerged at high tide, and at low tide it'll look kind of almost like a parking lot, this wide, flat expanse. And the theory is that this would have served as a very usable landing strip. The coral reef, the coral atoll, as they call it, that was dry at low tide.
So they might have landed there. The plane might have been there. They might have survived.
Mm-hmm.
But there would be times where they couldn't survive because high tide would leave them underwater completely?
Well, there was enough land for them to survive on, but the plane, if it had landed at low tide, would have been submerged at high tide.
Because of where they would have had to land. So they could
exactly.
make their way on the island to higher area
mm-hmm,
and survive,
exactly.
but the plane would have ended up getting underwater at some point because they couldn't have landed at the higher points.
Correct.
Okay.
And one of the projects that the Gillespie's folks have done is they have determined, based on extrapolation of radio logs, that at the time Amelia disappeared, she lost radio contact with Howland Island. Indeed, they could hear her, but she couldn't hear them, and there's a whole controversy about why that occurred, which we could get into another time. They determined that she had a certain amount of fuel available based on her last heard report
mm-hmm.
on Gardner. And so she was kind of going up and down. She couldn't find Howland Island, rather, which is a tiny island less than a square mile in the Pacific Ocean.
Which is where she was supposed to land to refuel, correct?
Correct. She was supposed to land to refuel there. There was actually a U.S. Coast Guard ship was anchored off of Howland Island, and their job was in part to help guide her into the island. This was in the days before radar or GPS. She had a very crude device, which at the time was state-of-the-art, but it was a precursor to radar called a radio direction finder, where you could send radio signals from one plane to another plane or from a plane to a ship, and those signals would kind of bounce back and forth and help you get your bearings. But it was complicated technology. A lot of it had to be done manually, and your radios had to work perfectly on both ends in order for the navigation technology to work. And what we have determined is that the receiver on Amelia's plane was not functioning properly.
How did they determine that? Just by the exchanges she was making from the air?
Correct. Like the ship, the Itasca, which was anchored off of Howland Island, could receive her transmissions, but she could not hear them. And she, you know, this has all been logged. You can read the radio logs as to what she said. She's like, I must, like, what the last thing that she said is like, I must be on you, but cannot see you
uh-huh.
and cannot hear you. And because she keeps saying, can you hear me? Can you hear me? And this was a voice. The fact she was also using voice as opposed to Morse code, which would have been more effective,
mm-hmm.
is another contributing factor. One of the things about Amelia Earhart was she was a very good technical manual pilot, but as the technology in aviation, especially navigation and instrumentation, was rapidly advancing in the late 1930s, she was known for being a little floppy about not keeping her skills up to date. And in one of those respects, she was really bad at Morse code. And to navigate an aircraft over wide expanses of water, not knowing Morse code, given that a lot of the navigation technology at the time was audio-based,
yeah.
radio direction, and over water, Morse code was the standard means of communication among ships even then because it was more reliable.
Well, she had a navigator with her. Didn't he know Morse code?
He didn't.
Oh. So that was a bad choice on her part.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about this real quick. Is there, you know, why have, it's amazing to me. I guess I shouldn't be surprised because we cannot find this plane that disappeared a year and a half ago. So why would we be able to find Amelia Earhart who disappeared in 1937? But if this island is such a focal point, I mean, this guy who you talked about who runs this organization has had a couple of, I read, unmanned submarines go there and look around. They haven't found anything. He's trying to raise money for a manned mission to go search. It's just amazing that if this is a good lead. And I thought I had read before, and I thought you and I had talked about, hadn't things been found on the island that they thought were hers or definitely were hers?
Well, they've never... Well, the one thing I like about TIGAR is that they are very much a scientifically focused organization, and they have said we can never say with 100% certainty that this is this was her campsite or this was her plane or whatnot unless one of two things or both are found, and that is conclusive DNA evidence. And although Amelia never had children, she did have nieces and nephews.
Mm-hmm.
I think at least one of whom is still alive, and then there are grandnieces and grandnephews still alive. So there is, and that was through her sister. So mitochondrial DNA, which is traced on the mother's bloodline, does survive. And those and DNA samples from those relatives have been collected. So if anything is ever found, they have a comparator. And a few things have been found, which I'll get to in a minute. The other determining factor would be if they find a part of the Lockheed Electra that they can actually, because they have all the schematics and specs of the Lockheed Electra, and her version of the Lockheed Electra was heavily modified. So there were a lot of components that were unique to that model, or the one that she actually flew as opposed to, like, the regular market version.
Mm-hmm.
And they can actually trace, like, a serial number or a part number. Those are the only two things that they will say 100%. Everything else is circumstantial but continues to add to the level of evidence base.
Are you surprised, though, that if the plane was there that they haven't been able to find it as of yet? Or is the shelf a very steep drop-off that if the plane was washed away by high tide, it would have actually traveled far when it traveled down under the ocean?
It would have traveled, like, miles and miles down the ocean. And the tide, as the tide kind of rolled in and out and in and out over a long period of time, it would have broken the aircraft up.
Hmm.
Now, there is some controversial evidence that there was a photograph taken by the same guy that actually found the bones. This was Gerald B. Gallagher, officer in charge of the Phoenix Island Settlement Scheme, which was actually a project instituted at the time by the British Imperial Government, that there were some photographs taken of that atoll, which was uninhabited at the time. It was eventually colonized by the British, but the colony failed just because it's just not a very hospitable place to live. It doesn't have a lot of fresh water, and it's very hot.
Mm.
But there was a photograph taken kind of by surveyors when they were surveying the island in 1940, and there was something popping up out of the water at high tide in a photograph that was kind of taken. It was off down to the lower corner of one of the photo, and it was easy to miss. And these photographs were available. They were found in that same archive that they found the bone measurements in, I believe. And as TIGAR often does, anytime they get any kind of evidence that was even remotely related to the Amelia Earhart disappearance, they do kind of run it through their whole community of scientists. And the same guy that did the analysis of the Amelia Earhart photographs that we just discussed, the humeral to radius ratio, had done an analysis of that photograph and found what looks like, this was just a couple of years ago, in the lower corner of that photograph, what looks to be an aircraft landing gear sticking up out of the water.
And all these people are there colonizing this island and don't go, hey, that's odd. Is that aircraft landing gear? Nobody picks that up and says, hey, guys, look at that.
Well, it's really far out on the horizon, so it would have been easy not to see it.
Okay.
And it took it took a forensic photo examiner quite a long time to do all these comparisons and data extrapolations and technology that wasn't even available then, because it was you look at it in the photograph and you could certainly say, oh, that's just a piece of driftwood or something like that.
Yeah.
But when they do all this data analysis, they found that the shadow and whatnot that is forecast in the photograph is consistent with a piece of landing gear.
Jill Elaine Hughes is a writer who is as she said, this is her pet project. She loves talking about this. Jill, I've got to take a break and do the news. I've got a couple more questions about this island, though. Would you mind hanging on just for a couple more minutes?
Sure.
All right. Jill Elaine Hughes is with us. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We're speaking with Jill Elaine Hughes. She's a prolific writer. Jill, I don't know exactly how to describe you as a writer because your writings are varied and very different. They're not, you've written all sorts of things. How do you describe yourself as a journalist?
Well, right now, I haven't been doing a lot of straight journalism lately. I've mostly been doing healthcare and scientific writing in the private sector over the past year or so. But mostly I built a journalism career over the years mostly by covering topics that a lot of my colleagues weren't interested in covering because they required science and or math.
Okay. We were told there would be no math.
Yes, exactly. So my editors would say, Jill, can you go cover this issue on a financial product that nobody
right.
understands, or can you go talk about this new medical device or new drug that's come out, or this illness or whatnot? And I'd have to go to the library and I'd have to read journals and which I actually kind of like doing and making that information kind of more accessible to the general public. That's something that I kind of specialized in and I think what you and I first came together on was a piece I wrote for the Tribune maybe about 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
On how the disappearance of Flight 370, the Malaysian Airlines flight,
right.
which we found pieces of, but we've never actually found the whole plane, and we still don't know why it went down, kind of mirrored the disappearance of the Earhart project.
Okay.
Or, excuse me, of Amelia Earhart.
Yeah. All right, so let's jump back in. So you can find Jill Elaine Hughes, .wordpress.com, and at Twitter at Jill E. Hughes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And also, but you've written some kind of adult-y novels, too.
Yeah, okay. That was my other little side project. Those are still out there. And it was almost something that, believe it or not, one reason that I'm interested in Amelia is not just her career as an aviator, but her personal life, which was quite the soap opera.
When are you going to write an Amelia Earhart book?
I actually have started one.
Okay.
And this would be a fictional version of her, kind of a fictional book told from her point of view, almost like an alternate history type of piece. And it would focus heavily on some of the love triangles in her life, of which there were many.
Okay.
She and G.P. Putnam had... And he was her Svengali, and this is G.P. Putnam of the G.P. Putnam Publishing Empire, which some of you may be familiar
sure.
with. He actually discovered Amelia in the late 20s, early 30s. This was at the time that Charles Lindbergh was this huge, huge celebrity because he had, successfully crossed the Atlantic solo, and he would be like Michael Jordan was in the 90s in
sure.
terms of his fame. Well, G.P. Putnam and his media kind of company, they wanted to kind of take someone like Charles Lindbergh, who was hugely famous, but then have a woman kind of be a counterpart to him, which they thought would be even bigger.
Yeah.
and essentially, as a media celebrity, but ultimately as a marketing tool.
And so what, is there some fair criticism that maybe she's not as talented as she was needed to be, but she was put in this position because she was a woman and because she was really good at this, and this will be a huge media sensation, so that
there is,
and maybe this is unfair to this person, but I would compare her slightly maybe to Danica Patrick then.
Yes, I think that's actually a good analogy. And Amelia was handpicked from a number of female pilots by G.P. Putnam, and he eventually became her husband, and he was her Svengali, if you will, who kind of groomed her to be a media celebrity. He interviewed a number of female pilots that, and Amelia was a legitimate pilot when she was picked, but she was not the best one by any means. Probably the best female pilot of her contemporaries, and is arguably one of the best pilots of all time, was named Jackie Cochran, who was a test pilot who even worked alongside Chuck Yeager. And she knew Amelia, and Jackie Cochran was even considered by NASA as an original Mercury astronaut. They decided kind of later in the program not to include women, but that's how good Jackie Cochran was. But I think you can certainly make the argument that Amelia, because she really was, and I'm a media person myself, one of the other reasons I'm fascinated with her, she was essentially, and I hate to use this comparison, but it's hard for us, you know, here in 2016 to kind of make that comparison. She's almost like a Kim Kardashian, which is a terrible analogy.
That's really unfair to Amelia, because she could fly a plane.
Yes, I mean, and Amelia was very smart, but she did have personal flaws. But Amelia's purpose, ultimately, was to sell products.
What was she selling? I mean, not anybody could buy an airplane. Was she doing, today she'd be doing Revlon commercials, I guess, but what was she selling at the time?
Well, she was selling everything from food and candy to promoting the development of commercial passenger aviation. She sold luggage. Amelia Earhart luggage was one of the many products that she put her name on,
which
is actually still made and sold today.
Get out of here. Are you serious?
Yes. I think that's that's the only thing still made today and still sold today that was part of her original endorsement deals. But a lot of the aviation and aircraft industry, which was growing at that time, kind of think of it the way like maybe mobile technology is today. You know, every time you turn on the TV, like if you watch the World Series recently, like almost every commercial was for this or that mobile carrier.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tons and tons of marketing for that. Well, that's comparable to what was going on in the 20s and 30s around the aviation industry.
Okay.
And so a lot of her flights that were highly publicized, they were underwritten by companies like Lockheed and, you know, aircraft manufacturers.
Because the more popular passenger travel became, the better it would be for those companies, so it was in their best interest to help promote it.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Let's jump back to Nikumaru Island, called Gardner Island at the time. And I'm looking at it, so I opened up my Apple map on my Mac here, and, you know, I just put it in, and now I'm able to see a 3D or a view of it from a satellite image, and like you said, it's a very interesting shape. One of the things I've read is that she would have had no fresh water at the time.
Oh, you're correct.
But she could have gotten it, they think, from rain that fell and water on leaves, different things like that, or figured out a way to collect rain when it fell. Now it looks like when you look at this island, though, there is, like you said, a big, you know, it's a big U shape, and most of the island is in the middle, water. Is that all salt water? Would that be fresh water in the middle that collects? Or
it would mostly be salt water, yes.
Okay.
There, as you said, there's a little bit of fresh water that collects here and there. There are some indications that, and this gets to what I was talking about before, some of the kind of archaeological artifacts that have been found on that island on the various expeditions that have been done over the years indicate that there may have been something used, like something she had on her plane, like a fuel canister.
Mm-hmm.
She had canned food, for example. Those things could all have been used to collect rainwater, for example. Small features on the island, you know, such as leaves, a little indentation in the ground like a puddle, whatnot, can be used to collect rainwater. There would have been some rainwater, but it would have been very, very difficult to survive long term without a fresh water source, which is a big reason why the British colony there, which I think the British had a colony on there for about 10 to 15 years, and they finally abandoned it because the water issue was a constant problem.
And how many people did they have living on this island? Because you look at it, and it's hard to tell. I mean, I think you said it's only about a mile altogether, right, this island?
No, that's actually Howland. That was only an hour. That's which is why Amelia had trouble finding it. Nikumaroro is a little bigger.
Okay.
But because of that unusual shape, the land is, it's like this very narrow strip that kind of goes around in a U. I don't think it was any more than maybe 100 people even at its height.
So are there buildings there now?
No. No, everything has basically been destroyed. The only thing that is there as far as the structure is concerned is a shipwreck called the USS Norwich City, which that shipwreck was a freighter that ran aground onto the Coral Atoll actually before Amelia would have landed there, assuming
okay.
she did. But and that shipwreck was there. It really can't be moved, and it's still there. You can, it's this big rusty hulk of part of a ship that's still sitting there.
Is there any wildlife there? Are there any trees there, or is this all just flat land?
There's a lot of heavy, tropical vegetation. There are some trees that are kind of left over, I believe, from when the British tried to colonize it. They had tried to grow, for example, coconuts and a couple of crops, and I think there might be a few remnants of that, but it's mostly, ground vegetation. As far as wildlife, it's mostly seabirds and turtles.
Okay, so there wouldn't have been a lot of opportunity for her to necessarily catch wild boars or anything like that.
Right, yeah, there wouldn't have, there's definitely no wild boars there. There were also a lot of crabs, so she certainly could have eaten the crabs and fish, and assuming you could catch fish, using equipment maybe modified off of the ship, or excuse me, off of the plane, and turtles. And this archaeological site that has been discovered on the far corner of the island, and archaeologists have done multiple digs there as part of the expeditions that Tigar has done, has found evidence over multiple digs that suggest that there was a castaway there. And there have been a number of findings that have led to that conclusion, including a fire site. And this was actually the reason they can identify this as a castaway versus the colony is that this is at the opposite end of the island from where the colony would have been.
But if the colony was there for 10 years, people ventured off at some times to explore the land, maybe camped or things like that, wouldn't
True.
They think?
True. That has also been discussed. But they've done some carbon dating, I believe, that I think helps narrow it somewhat. And then the nature of some of the artifacts seems to indicate that they would have been before the colony actually was established.
It's really fascinating. Jill, why don't we just catch a plane and go head out there and check it out? I mean, is it how if you said, you know what, I'm going to go see this for myself, how difficult would that be to get there? And to...
It's extremely difficult. This is one of the most remote places on planet Earth.
You'd have to fly where and then take a boat for how long to pull it off?
Pretty much, I believe when Tigar has gone, I believe they have flown to Fiji, which is the closest you can get to as far as a major commercial airport is concerned. And then they have to charter a boat to get there. And it takes a week, is my understanding, to get, or it can take 5 days to a week. And some of this has to do with rough seas, so it's not just distance. So it takes several days, depending on the rough seas, to get there by boat. And then they basically can only do these expeditions for maybe 8 to 10 days tops. And even that is hard because climate, it's an equatorial climate. It's literally right on the equator.
Mm-hmm.
It's just brutal. They have to bring in all of their fresh water, all of their food. They have to generate power, using generators, whatnot. So it's really hard to get there, and when you're there, it's really hard to stay. So they kind of go and they cram all of their work into this few number of days, and then they gather up everything and put it back on the ship, and they go back to Fiji and fly out of Fiji. So it's quite the expedition.
Man. It's fascinating. I could talk to you about it all night. Let's plan to talk again about it down the road. And I just would love to learn more about the island itself. It's just amazing that we have these places in the world where people have been or people have tried to live on, and we can't really pull it off. And there could be evidence just sitting right there somewhere that she was there at some point. The plane could be just off the shore somewhere underneath the water, or at least pieces of it to make it happen. And, you know, whether it's MH370 or this, it's just amazing that there's still these mysteries in the world that we just can't solve.
Yeah. And next time we talk, I could talk more about some of the other artifacts that have been found. That could take a whole segment. But, like, if you think about it, if you look at how difficult it is to even get to this island now in 2016, the analogy, like, in 1937 when Amelia was attempting this to circumnavigate the globe, using pretty primitive aviation technology by our standards, it would roughly be equivalent to us trying to go to Mars now.
Well, and it's amazing when I look at it on the map, and then I just back away, like you can back away, back away, back away, back away. The world is curving before I see land again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how far away she was from anything else. So that she even found an island to put the plane down on would be a miracle in and of itself.
Absolutely.
If she was lost at the time. It's fascinating stuff. Jill Elaine Hughes, you can find her, jillelainehughes.wordpress.com, or follow her on Twitter at Jill E. Hughes. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone this morning.
Thank you.
All right, Jill Hughes, we will talk to her again. Amelia Earhart, I find it fascinating.